from WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is Johannes Werner with your WSLR news headlines for Wednesday, November 20th. The Sarasota School Board at a meeting yesterday swore in Tom Edwards, who was re-elected, and Liz Barker, who ousted former chair Karen Rose in the August elections. The board unanimously elected Tim Enos as chair. Vice chair became Robin Marinelli in a split 3-2 vote. Also in a 3-2 vote, the school board approved shrinking the number of meetings from 2 to 1 per month. Critics say this reduces transparency and the public's opportunity to be heard. Most of the evening meetings now begin at 6 p.m. rather than 3 p.m. Sarasota County says it wants to keep Midnight Pass open. County Administrator Jonathan Lewis sent a letter to the Florida Department of Environmental Protection. In it, he said that after the recent hurricane's reopening of Midnight Pass on South Siesta Key, the county intends to keep the waterway open. This follows discussion at the last county commission meeting after two recent storms reopened the waterway that was closed by neighboring homeowners in 1983. Let It Flow advocates argue that an open Midnight Pass will improve water quality in the bay. Flooding from Hurricane Milton forced Sarasota's Van Wezel Performing Arts Hall to cancel or reschedule all programs until January 2nd. Now, 5 weeks later, the box office reopened with new dates set for some of the shows. The Van Wezel staff had to move to temporary offices while working to reschedule as many shows as possible and handle ticket refunds and exchanges. 26 shows were affected by the closure. 3 shows have been moved to other venues. 2, including the Almond Betts Family Revival, will be staged at Ruth Eckert Hall in Clearwater, and 1 at the Sarasota Opera. Storm surge flooded the orchestra pit with several feet of water, requiring a replacement lift. Repairs will cost between $7 and $10 million. Seaport Manatee, the county-owned deepwater port, reported record cargo activity of nearly 12 million tons for the recently ended fiscal year. That was an increase of more than 7% from the previous year. Seaport Manatee sustained heavy damages as a result of Hurricane Milton, but the port was able to resume fuel distribution activities within just 4 days. This has been Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for Wednesday, November 20th.
Welcome to the Peace and Justice Report. My name is Bob Connors. Excuse me. And John Dickman is here on the control board. And this is the Peace and Justice Report. And the opinions you hear today are strictly those of the host and the guest and do not necessarily reflect those of the management team, the board of directors, or any of the volunteers affiliated with the station. So, John, we have a new underwriter. Want to tell us about them?
Yeah, support for WSLR and Fogartyville comes from Pepo's Shoes. They're offering handmade footwear crafted by Colombian artisans using leather and a variety of textiles. Each pair is designed to be one of a kind. Pepo's Shoes can be found at the Sarasota Farmers Market every Saturday. More information is available at Pepo's Shoes. That's PEPOSSHOES.com.
Thank you, John, and thank you, Pepo's Shoes. And we have a very special guest in the studio this morning, and his name is Juan Pablo Salas, and he was the director of a play that just happened this past weekend, Voices of Immigration. So, Juan, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Bob, and thank you for bringing me to WSLR.
So I'd like to have you tell the audience about the play that just took place, some of the background, how it came about, and Anything and everything you'd like to tell us about the play and how it went off this past weekend and where it happened, of course.
Wonderful. So this was a play created by Crearte Latino. This is a local organization of Latino artists and organizers who are together setting up these kind of plays and creating a community environment for the Hispanic and the Latino community to thrive in the area. So back in September, there was a presentation following a style of theater called testimonial theater, which is a little bit different than the theater you used to go. When you go to a theater, you see the stage, and the stage usually is set up in a way that presents the work where the action happens, and then you see the actors say words and move around the stage. In this case, it's testimonial theater, so it's more like a reading. So the actors will deliver the words of people we've interviewed. So back in April, Crearte Latino presented Voces de la Maternidad, Voices of Maternity. And I went to see the play, and like many other people, and it was impactful because you hear real life testimony happening before your eyes, and the actors are really good at delivering this message. So at the end of the play, I talked to Crearte Latino director and other peoples, and we agreed that it was a good idea to follow up with Voices of Immigration, Voices of Immigration, because this is an ongoing issue and will continue to be an ongoing issue, and it is something that is very important at this precise moment in history. We were going through a very important election, and immigrants were the punch bag of the nation. So everyone is talking about them, but no one is giving them voices. And them is not them. This is not people that are strange to the world. This is, I am myself, I'm an immigrant. Yeah, I have my papers and my citizenship and everything, but I'm still an immigrant. So we wanted to portray all those stories because there is no voice for the immigrants here. But we want to do it in a respectful way, and we want to do it in a controlled environment, and we want to do it with respect to the society and the community where this is presented. So we went out and searched for people who wanted to give us their testimonies. How was your immigration? Why did you decide to come? What are the obstacles you had to overcome? And we collected all these testimonies and selected not only the ones we consider are more representative of a bunch of people, but also what sections of their words are more visually or content better for the play. And we curated all the content. In the end, you end up with about an hour of text, which includes 12 testimonies. So that's 12 different people. You have 6 actors on stage. So what they do is they deliver these voices. Some of them have to deliver more than one voice. And then throughout the hour, we follow a path, because otherwise it's very difficult to follow the conversation. So we follow a path, which is the way basically how we made the interviews. Like, we told the trip, the travel. That is, what made you decide to move to the United States? How was your travel, your path? When you arrived, what happened? What were your main challenges? Did you find what you were looking for? And in the end, we asked, does the American dream exist? So each one of the persons we interviewed responded to all these questions, and we just followed that path. So when you come out of the play after seeing it, you have an overview of different realities of the immigration experience. People who went through the jungle, people who crossed rivers, or people who arrived on an airport, on a regular airplane, or people who came from a port. I mean, the immigration experience is of all kinds. People with documents, people who came here with a lot of money, people who came here with no money at all. And this collection of stories tell you much more than just the words of people everywhere else talking about them, but not asking them what the reality is. So it is impactful. People who go to the play are touched. Every night we had a conversation with the public after the play. We open up the microphone and people can ask questions or make comments. And we also, there is something very special that we do in Criarte Latino, which is every word is translated into English. So, or back into Spanish if the person delivers in English. Like when the play is going on top of the persons, there is a screen, and on the screen, the English words are being delivered at exactly the same time the person is delivering. This is prepared beforehand. So any Anglo audience can go to a play and understand completely what is being said. And then when we have the conversation, we also do the work of listening in their language and translating back into the opposite language. So everyone receives the message and everyone has the way to deliver that. So I think it is a not only educational for everyone, even for us. Every night, I went to all the rehearsals, I did the interviews, I curated the text, everything. And every night I went to the play, I learned something new. Wow. From the same words, from the same experiences.
Have you done plays like this before, or is this something totally
new? No, this is the
totally
first time
new.
I do this kind of theater. But I've done thousands of interviews, so it is kind of a combination of both.
Well, what is your background that you've done thousands of interviews?
I am a radio host as well. So
oh, you're a radio host?
And I'm a journalist. So,
oh, you're a journalist.
And part of my work is to interview people every week.
So right here in Sarasota?
Right here in Sarasota, yeah.
Very good.
Like right here in Sarasota, I've interviewed more than 500 people in the 5 years that I've been here, just because I have a show and I can bring people over and they tell me their stories. So
right.
I use the same technique in the sense that, okay, let's have a conversation, and people end up telling me very nice stories of their own lives. So I took that experience into the performing the interviews and then selecting the words. But the play itself is a new format for all of us. So we were kind of building as we were rehearsing, because we understood that the format requires certain things. Like, this is a readout. This is not a regular play. So we're not going to set up the characters in costume. That's not only not necessary, but it is inconvenient, because then you're making your testimony become kind of a caricature.
Right.
Of themselves.
Right.
So the clothing is plain and the delivery is intentional, of course, and with emotion, but it's not too dramatic. It's not like to make you cry. What we want is the word, the testimony itself to be listened to, but we want it to be properly delivered. So the rehearsal is rereading of the words until the actor finds a proper voice to deliver that message. So we allowed the actor, but it was our decision, to use accents if they can play with accents. So someone from Guatemala has a different accent than someone from Venezuela. So if you can play or somehow give us the differentiation, do so. But you're not required to use a wig or to put on a colorful clothing, because that's not part of what we do. And that means that it is a very clean environment. You just see the actors on stage, and then you see in front of them their piece of what they're going to read. So it is a struggle a little bit to maintain the tone high so people don't get distracted. So it's a challenge. It's a very interesting challenge. And we were working on that. Like, how do you deliver your message in a way that the people still listening to you 45 minutes into the play? The stories are so good and so engaging that we didn't have any problems like people getting tired or bored at all. Not at all. It is such an engaging story, and the testimonies are so so tough that you have to pay attention. You have to listen.
So you had 12 people. So how many did you have to interview several people to get 12, or did you just feel the situation out and you pick 12 people from just kind of talking?
We interview more than 12 people, and yeah. We selected the most, what we thought were the most representative of certain stories, because we could tell all, I mean,
right.
But then you spend a whole day.
Right.
So you need to shrink it down to a playable situation, something that people can listen to. So we took all those interviews, we selected what we consider the best stories, and of those stories, we shortened them, because someone tell you a very nice story about their trip, and some of the trips are really, I mean, the voyage is really tough, so you want to stay there and follow that particular testimony. But maybe another one has a very good reflection about what the American dream is.
Right.
So you bring those words at the end. So each one of the testimonies may be on or not in every chapter, but
right.
The whole overall story gives you a complete idea of what the immigration experience is.
So the play was 1 hour, right?
About an hour, yeah.
An hour. So mm-hmm. I'm thinking, I'm dividing 12 into 1 hour. I mean,
yeah.
That's like, what, eight minutes
eight
a piece?
8 minutes per character,
eight
per
minutes.
Person.
So 8 minutes is not that much time when you're trying to get a sense of this person coming from Guatemala, Venezuela, how they happened to get here, what was it like when they arrived, did they have family here, did they get a job, and was it like men and women, young people, old people? Was it
Yeah, so we selected men and women. We found out that women are more able to deliver their story. They're willing to tell the story. It was more difficult to find men. So we had only two men playing men testimonies, and four women playing each one of them two females. So it depended on how many of each gender would talk to us, but also we selected different stories. So there is a story about DACA. So it's a person who arrived here as a kid and still has no papers, although 30-something years old. So its challenges are different. What is the reason for your traveling? Well, my mom decided to bring me. So she doesn't have a long story of how the travel was, because her memory is of a child. But then you have another one who can tell you every detail of how the trip was, because it just happened a year ago. So they have all the details still fresh in their mind. So what we did was to select each one, like, the DACA story needs to go because it represents about a million people. We need to have someone who crossed the Darien gap because a lot of people is going through that. Well, we didn't have exactly someone who did, but her husband did. So it's part of the same story. We also wanted to have something that was not, everybody's suffering. No, some people just come here normally. Like, they get their papers beforehand and they arrive here. And they, like myself, I am a citizen now. I arrive here with a residency, but that doesn't mean that my experience is not valuable. It's different.
Right.
So we wanted to have the tough story, the successful story, the very sad story, the happy story, because the idea is that the immigrant experiences all kinds of experience.
Right.
Everyone has a different experience, but leaving your house, leaving your family, leaving your country, getting to a new place, learning a new language, finding a job, getting papers, how was your trip, how are you going to make friends, you're going to build a new family. All those are common themes and issues that every immigrant anywhere needs to solve. So that's what we wanted. We wanted to put all that like in a potluck. Everyone brings their story, and together the story is transcendent. Alone, the story may be not.
Can I ask a question?
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah, out of all these interviews, and especially the plays and the acting in it, and I don't know if those are the right words, but what things in particular, say a couple things that you get out of that moves you the most, that has the most effect on you? Is it possibly the difficult trip there, the wonderfulness of discovering America and what's potential? What did you walk away from that with the most?
In my case, I think what I admire most is the strength and resilience of people, the resistance, their constant struggle and still coming out either successful or at least survive. That is one thing. It's like there is an internal engine driving every one of these persons to do whatever they have to do in order to achieve a new goal. What I also learned is that the American dream is a dream. Yes. Therefore, it is fully unreliable and fully unrealizable, but it is a driving force. It is like a flame. So you follow the flame because you want to achieve it. But each one has a completely different story about what their American dream is. There is no American dream as such. There is an idea, and the idea is different on every person. And I think that's an important lesson, because there is not one way to tell this story. You have to tell it in many ways for it to make sense. And that's why I don't like the way that politicians nowadays are using the story of immigrants to deliver a hateful message. Because what we see in the play and in all the testimonies is that everyone in that group is full of love for the family, full of love for their country, but still they're full of love for their future and their destiny. So they're looking for something new. None of them will tell you that they come here to harm anyone or to damage anything or to not follow the law. Everyone is telling exactly the opposite. They tell you, and you hear that several times through the play, if you come here and you do what you're supposed to do, you're okay and you're going to succeed. Everyone has that clear. But when you listen outside of that dialogue, what's been said is exactly the opposite. So we had the chance to bring out and allow a different voice to be heard. We wanted that voice to be clean, so we didn't insert any politics into the play. And the testimonies were not political, because the questions we asked were not about, oh, what do you think about this politician saying this about you? None of that was in our questions or their delivery. It was the story. What made you come here? How was your trip? How did you cross? What happened when you arrived? What are you doing now, and what are you going to do in the future? None of those has anything to do with politics. But underneath all these stories, there is a veil of politics that is happening. People who will continue to move around the globe looking for better opportunities, that's not going to ever stop.
So were most of these people immigrants from south of the border, Mexico, Central and South America?
Since it's Crearte Latino is a Latino cultural center,
okay,
we decided
that
it was correct from us to bring about those stories. I would love to also include other experiences, because I know that there is a lot of Ukrainians here. There is a thriving Vietnamese community. There is people from other countries that would also love to have that.
Middle Eastern,
of course.
Yep, yep.
But this is a Latino cultural center, so the experience was focused on that particular experience. But I think it's universal in the sense that everyone is pretty much going for the same. I have an issue at home. I need to fix it somewhere else.
Right.
How do I arrive there? And what's the difficulties I'm going to go through in order to solve that?
Well, there's one question that I think the listeners might have, as well as I have, because you always hear that so many people come here because they want to send money back home and support their family back home because, you know, conditions and the cost of living and everything else south of the border, people are struggling. So was that the case with most of these people any of them?
People left their countries for several reasons. Poverty was one of them. Violence is another one. Very important. Now, not all violence is political.
Loss of freedoms.
Loss of freedoms. So the motives are different, but once they arrive, everyone is always thinking about the people they left and how they can help them. So yes, that's the driving force for most of them. Now, South America, Central America have a long story of immigration. So we were able to find people who came here years and years ago and people who just arrived. And their experiences, although separate in time and perhaps different in details, is pretty much essentially the same.
Right.
I have an issue. I want to solve it. I might be able to solve it over there. And then I go there. So I think it was a very enlightening experience for us. Elvira Sanchez Blake and I were the co-directors. We did all the interviews and we curated the text, but the technical people and the artistic people from the cultural center was essential. This is not something that you say, okay, say this. No, you need to prepare. People need to rehearse. The environment has to be proper. There was lighting appropriately set up, and the group actually had about 3 weeks to set up the location, because the cultural center moved from the original location close to the airport down to over here, 301 and Northgate. Now we're located there. So 3 weeks before we presented, there was nothing there. So they had to set up the carpet and build everything, so we could rehearse and play, and then people had a very nice experience. The location is beautiful, and we can do many things there. But it was also a challenge, as well as going through three different hurricanes as we were preparing all these, and an election, which was pivotal as well. So all these challenges added to not only the complicated task of building it, but also to the emotion of seeing it play.
You know, how many nights with the play held? Were there more than one night?
We had three nights.
Three nights.
And we had very good public on each one of them. The audience was good in numbers.
Did you have a sense for, was it mostly Caucasian or was it
Latino? It was a good mix of people.
A good mix?
Lots of Latino and lots of Anglo people. We market to all that were mm-hmm. listening, so we had a good mixture of both English and Spanish within the public, within the audience, and that was part of the purpose. It's like, this is something that is happening in Spanish, but we want people in English to fully understand. I mean, it's total transparency. When someone mentions something, I was in charge of translating that, and I always try to and then I have a test right there, because other people do speak both languages, so if I translate something that is not correct, people are going to complain. Right. So I need to deliver properly, but that's what we wanted. We wanted both cultures, or all the cultures, to be able to understand each other. And I think we achieved that.
So do you think you'll do this same play again, maybe in the middle of the season?
With
the
hope so.
Snowbirds here? It sounds like something that would go over.
One of the things that there is a calendar for Core Arte Latino. So there is already a calendar, and I don't know if these particular plays within that calendar. But one of the things that people came to tell us every time was, this needs to be played somewhere else. Why don't you bring it there? Why don't you go to Orlando? Why don't you go to Miami? So we're looking for options. Right. Yes, we would bring it somewhere else.
Yes.
But I am of the idea that the method is even better, because, yes, I want to go places with this play and tell these stories to others, absolutely. But this is something that can be replicated everywhere, because as long as you follow the method of doing the appropriate research and doing it with actors and preparing yourself and being respectful of the format, you can replicate this in Madrid, or you can replicate this anywhere, because immigration is, and that this is something that I wanted to add, is a global story. This is not an American story. America has an issue now with it, but immigration is a global story. It will never stop. People will continue to move around. And we, as a country, are blessed to be the destination of so much talent and so much willingness to live and be productive. To me, it is a mistake trying to stop that force.
You're listening to the Peace and Justice Report, and Juan Pablo Salas is here, the director of Voices of Immigration. And Juan, we have about five more minutes, and you know, it's really fascinating. I can remember seeing a play that was similar to this. It was about 15 years ago at the Studio Theater, and there were actors who were reciting the words, and for the life of me, I can't remember what that play was about or what the storyline was. But as you said, this can be replicated anywhere, and in many different subject matters as
absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely. You know. The first one Crearte Latino did was about maternity, which is another wonderful story, because there is a legend that every mother must feel the same thing. And when you ask the mothers, each experience is completely different. Some of them are very happy to have their kids and some others suffer because they have their kids. So the whole maternity experience is completely different on each mother or non-mother. So the same with immigration. But you can do this with gender. You can do this. I am thinking about doing something about men. I think men need to ask themselves who they are, what they want, where they're going, what are the values. Because everybody's talking about men, but no one is asking men about them. So I would like to follow up with something like that. I don't know if the idea would ever stick, but it's my curiosity. I would like
to. Well, you have two men right here.
There you go. I would interview you guys and see what's going on.
I'd be interested in that.
There's three of us.
I've been wondering about this my whole life. You have the thoughts in your mind and say, why am I here? What am I doing with my life? And, you know, am I making an impact? Or, you know, who are those people who I'm closest to that I feel connected with, that I can share stories with? So I think that's a wonderful idea.
Yeah, let's see if that's the one that sticks. I know that the group Crearte Latino, Carolina Franco, who is the executive director, and the artistic people have many dreams about what else to do.
Right.
But I think this format is perfect for these kind of questions. Tough questions that you can deliver in a respectful way. And there is something about the theater setup that allows a good conversation to happen, which is something that I want to highlight as well. These are very tough conversations. If you go to a square and try to have this conversation, you may end up having a shout-out match with people. But the theater environment, the fact that you are confined to a location and you're sharing a seat with other people and there is a stage and there is the audience.
As an audience, your responsibility is to let the performers perform.
Exactly. So there is a respect right there on the set, the way it is designed and the way we as a culture are educated. So it allows for the conversation to happen. And if you are respectful and people is respectful delivering the message, we can have very deep questions asked and very good responses answered. So I think it's a valuable tool. And I am going to attempt to do more stuff like this.
Definitely. Oh, that'd be great.
It would be pretty easy to have women go to something like that, but might have a hard time having men talk about men and men going to listen.
That is the challenge, and
that's
I think it is a very important challenge, and someone's got to tackle it one day or another. If it's not me, somebody else will have to do it. We are in the middle of a machista revolution, And we need to understand why we arrived to this place. And I have my ideas about it, and I would like to have other people to discuss them. But right now we have a beautiful play called Voices of Immigration, Voces de Inmigración. And I think that on its own is such a powerful voice that it needs to get to places. So if you guys, anyone on the audience, believes that we can bring this play to a university, another theater, somewhere else, do contact CrearteLatino.org, and we'll be glad to consider it.
I just give you a call? Can I just give you a call?
Yes, they do. Absolutely.
Yes. Well, what else is happening at the center that you can let people know
about? Well, we are getting to the end of the year. So
right.
I know we do there is a beautiful format called Tertulia, which is like a conversation of friends. So we share stories, and we usually bring three or four authors who share their poetry or their... This is happening in Booster One. It's one every quarter. We also have classes for kids, music. We're teaching them music, and we're also... there are other classes for kids. We have Spanish classes, English classes... the cultural center is thriving, and there are lots of activities happening. So just pay attention to the sign. There are events happening throughout the year, and we have a new location, which is going to give us the opportunity to do even more stuff.
Oh, that's
than
great!
Before, so
that's great.
You'll hear more of us.
That's the Northgate location.
The Northgate location.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Juan Pablo, for coming in today.
Thank you, Bob, for bringing me.
I wish I had known about the play previous to happening, but I'm going to look forward to finding a location. It seems like many, many different colleges, and you know, we got St. Petersburg to the north, we got Venice to the south. I really feel that it would be well received, no matter where it shows, where it plays.
It's well deserved, I think. The moment is appropriate for that.
Yeah.
Thank you guys for bringing me.
You're
and
welcome.
Thank you for the audience who pay attention.
You're welcome. Hang on just a minute, Juan Pablo, because I'm hoping to play a 3-minute audio here while I call my next guest. And this is from Prison Radio, Mumia Abu-Jamal. And the title of this commentary is The End of Empire. So let me see if we can get that on.
The End of Empire? For years, I've studied the histories of empires, especially their rise and their fall. Europe's most illustrious example, Rome, grew from a city to a state and finally a world empire. When their men tired of fighting, they trained non-Romans in their war tactics. And when they were treated with contempt by Romans, they responded by sacking the city and stealing their treasure before leaving. It wasn't the end of Rome, but it was a signal of the beginning of the end. Empires rise and empires fall. That is a lesson of history. A century ago, Britain boasted that the sun would never set on the British Empire. A few world wars later, and after decolonization struggles, and it is an empire no more. Its recent Brexit episode has cleaved its economic strength, and most foreign observers see it as a self-inflicted wound. It shows us that great empires can succumb to a kind of suicide. Now, what of the American empire? Is it immune to the lessons of history? Half a century ago, it lost a war to a poor Asian nation. After, it inflicted millions of casualties upon them. The country that won the war was called Vietnam. Just days ago, it elected an immoral man whose only real claim to fame was his bank account. Because of this election, America has no voice with which to tell other countries how to elect their leaders. It has no voice in questions of morality. It has great power, yes. But that didn't win in Vietnam, nor in Afghanistan, where they simply outweighed the Americans. Empires are not immortal. They may last for centuries, yes, but ultimately they rise and they fall. With love, not fear, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Yes, we have a special guest on the phone. Jeremy, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Yes, we have Jeremy Kusmarov of the Covert Action magazine, and we've had Jeremy on before, and he's a prolific writer and a researcher, and if you go to Covert Action magazine, he'll usually have a few pieces every week, as well as other contributors to the magazine, and they're always quite relevant to what's going on. And the one that you just wrote yesterday, it just appeared yesterday. I'm sure you did a lot of research because you were talking about many members who have been chosen by the next president to be in his cabinet. And the headline featured Marco Rubio. What a great pick he was, or is. Of course, I'm just joking. Maybe you can talk about that piece that just came out yesterday about many of the cabinet picks.
Sure, yeah. This just provides a review of Trump's, particularly picks on foreign policy, you know, for the key positions. And I think we see right away, you know, the illusion that Trump kind of packaged himself as a somewhat of a peace candidate in the election and said he was going to, you know, not start any new wars and end some of the war, particularly Ukraine. But, you know, we see he picked some very, very hawkish figures. And this is kind of characteristic of Trump's career, because back in 2016, he was sounding some of the similar themes at this election cycle. And I think it's just kind of, you know, Trump is a savvy politician. For all the bluster, you know, the emotion that he evokes, he's pretty savvy politically. And like other politicians, he'll say things, you know, to appeal to a particular base. I mean, there are a lot of conservative libertarians who want to see a smaller government, including cuts in the military. And, I mean, a lot of the population is weary of these endless wars, so he's just trying to capitalize on that. But then he goes ahead and appoint the neoconservatives. I mean, he did that in 2016 when he appointed figures like Mike Pompeo and John Bolton to run his foreign policy. And now we have Marco Rubio, who's a representative of the expat community, you know, Cuban community in Miami. And they're known for their extremist right-wing political viewpoint and their obsession with overthrowing left-wing governments in Cuba as well as throughout Latin America. And Rubio has championed, you know, regime change operations like in Venezuela. And he was, you know, particularly close with right-wing figures like Juan Guaido and Leopoldo Lopez, whom the U.S. And CIA had been championing. And they even recognized Guaido as a legitimate Venezuelan leader, which was unprecedented when he had no support. He never won anything within Venezuela. And he's a crook. His network stole a lot of money, embezzled money that was budgeted for a paramilitary operation they were mounting against the Maduro government. And Rubio is very close with Nayib Bukele, the El Salvador leader. You know, he praises him. He claims to be supporting a world crusade for democracy, but he supports, like in Latin America, one of the most authoritarian leaders, Nayib Bukele, who's locked up a record number of people in this drive on gangs and a major human rights going on in El Salvador that don't get a lot of attention as part of this overzealous war on crime. You know, they don't institute economic policy that would lead to economic opportunity for young people. And then they adopt these harsh crime laws. And often innocent people are caught in the police dragnets. And the prisons are grossly overcrowded. There are massive human rights abuses. And that's a guy. And also, he's concentrated power totally among his own office. But Rubio is very close to him. And, you know, says nothing. You know, he rails against Maduro and some leftist governments for their alleged authoritarianism. But praises this guy Bukele, who's really a tyrant in El Salvador. And yeah, he's been hawkish on China. He's a strong China hawk. And even on Ukraine and Israel, you know. And I mean, you know, other picks, Trump's cabinet is really zealously pro-Israel and aligned with the right wing, you know, within Israel that is carrying out ethnic cleansing and genocidal policies and triggering wars in Lebanon and potentially Iran. And so, I mean, these picks don't inspire confidence about the future.
Oh, Jeremy, can you hear me?
Go ahead.
Jeremy, I just want to mention two things. Number one, of course, the opinions you hear today are strictly those of the host and the guests and do not necessarily reflect those of the management team, board of directors, or any of the volunteers affiliated with the station. But related to this, Jeremy, Tulsi Gabbard, you know, did much campaigning for Trump before the election, and she always made it clear that things were going to change when Trump got elected. Because he isn't interested in getting involved in any foreign wars, and it will end the ones that we're involved in right now, specifically Ukraine and Russia. But I was shaking my head every time she said this, only because of what the people he put in charge in 2016. But now, the last 2 weeks, and the people that you're talking about. So go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt. I just wanted to make it clear that, you know, you were right as far as painting himself as all for peace. But the people he puts in there, is attempting to put in, don't reflect that at all. So go ahead, Jeremy.
Absolutely, yeah, and thanks for those comments. Yeah, and I mean, Tulsi Gabbard is kind of wild card. I mean, yeah, she, you know, I went to a rally, Rage Against the War Machine, a year and a half ago in Washington, and she was one of the speakers, and gave a very eloquent speech criticizing U.S. policy in Ukraine and warning about the dangers of nuclear war, and she discussed how she had brought up some of her concerns in the 2020 election cycle, and that she was shouted down and demeaned by other in the Democratic Party, like Kamala Harris and Hillary Clinton. And yeah, now she's been appointed as Director of National Intelligence. And, you know, she's been attacked by John Brennan and Debbie Wasserman Schultz. They've come out and said she's a Russian agent, asset, and this is an irresponsible pick. I mean, I'm happy she's in there. You know, she may be able to, you know, change things up a bit, particularly in intelligence. But I mean, she's just one person. Yeah, when you have all these war hawks, and I mean, I think that's very strategic. Again, we have to look at Trump as a very calculating politician. And I mean, he allies with Gabbard, I think, to draw people from the anti-war movement into his campaign, people who are, you know, disaffected with the Democratic Party warmongering. And so, I mean, he's followed through and appointed to her to an important position, but she's only one person in a sea of neoconservatives. And, I mean, Trump himself, in his first term, you know, he raised the military budget, which was already very high before, and he promoted things like the U.S. Space Force, the militarization of outer space. So, I mean, Trump's own priority is very clear, and he defended war criminals like Eddie Gallagher, the guy who killed and tortured teenagers in Iraq, and Trump was defending him. And, you know, this new defense secretary has come out on the record against, you know, military prosecutions for war crimes. So that's not encouraging at all. But, and I think you have this kind of, you know, rhetoric from this guy, Hegseth, that I think Trump embraces that, yeah, we want to end the war basically after we wipe them out. So, like for Israel, Gaza, you know, people in his cabinet are saying, well, let's finish the job. Yeah, we'll have peace, but after we wipe out all the Palestinians. And that's really a formula more for genocide and for more war, because the Palestinian will continuously resist, so it's an illusion that they can just wipe them out unless they kill every last one of them. So, you know, I'm not too optimistic. And, I mean, you know, presidents in the past, if you study U.S. history, they will often run on a peace platform and never follow through. Like Woodrow Wilson, his campaign platform slogan in 1916 was, he kept us out of the war, World War One, but then he was secretly maneuvering behind the scenes, even during the election campaign, to get the U.S. into the war. And Lyndon Johnson campaigned in 64 on a peace platform. So, you know, Trump doesn't have really a track record of being a humanitarian or somebody really committed to peace. Even in the Vietnam War, he was an adult then. He got out of the draft, but he was never involved with the anti-war movement, the principal people who tried to oppose the war and stop it. And he's not a principled person, and he's a con man, so you can't trust what a con man says. And most politicians, unfortunately, are con men as well.
Well, let me bring up another person you wrote about, and you also mentioned it was the Secretary of Defense, and you would mention how Lloyd Austin, as soon as he got in there, compare this new Secretary of Defense with what General Lloyd Austin did, as far as the amount of contracts he gave to Raytheon after leaving Raytheon.
Yeah, and those of us who are, you know, good people who want peace in the world and don't endorse violence, unless our home is attacked or something, you're going to stand up for yourself, but you don't want to go around provoking wars all over the world. We have nobody, because the Democrats have a horrible track record, certainly in the last 4 years, of provoking wars, of supporting the military-industrial complex, and Lloyd Austin is a perfect example of that. He was Biden's appointment as defense secretary. Well, he was a general who had overseen the head of the Central Command in the Middle East, and he had overseen major military operations and bombing in Iraq and war crimes in Iraq, and then he'd been appointed to the board of directors of Raytheon, one of the largest weapon-producing companies in the world, headquartered in Massachusetts and Arizona, and then as defense secretary, because I tracked this for some articles for Covert Action magazine, and it became too difficult to track as time went on. But for the first 6 months, I tracked it, and he issued $10 billion in contracts to Raytheon, which, you know, Biden, Trump set record military budgets, and then the Biden administration upped the ante even further, and the military budget's approaching $1 trillion. And, you know, Ukraine, Israel, Gaza, Taiwan, these are, you know, boondoggles for the military-industrial complex, the U.S. Space Force, and these companies like Raytheon make a killing. There's so many contracts they're being awarded. So, you know, this new defense secretary, as I point out in the article, Pete Hegseth, yeah, he defended war criminals, and he basically has a fascist outlook. I mean, he scapegoats liberals and, you know, diversity for weakening the U.S. military, and he wants to, you know, make the military stronger. And in some of his writing, he basically calls for, you know, he said we were too weak. We should have gone full hilt and wiped them out, you know, whether it's ISIS or Hamas. So he's not really advocating peace. He's just advocating more aggressive military action to wipe out American enemies, although he did, I think, call for a moratorium on defense, like an Austin who can work for or be appointed to the board of weapons contractors, that generals and Pentagon officials for 10 years shouldn't be allowed to work for defense contractors. So that is something positive he advocated for. Maybe despite some of his horrific views, it's possible he could be better than Austin if he follows through on that, and we see an attempt to put a stop to what we call the revolving door, where military and government officials go to work for the defense contractors in this close symbiotic relationship. And that's something Dwight Eisenhower had warned about in his famous speech on the military-industrial complex years ago. But, I mean, it's up to the public, I think, to develop pressure campaigns and mass movements for these principles, for challenging the military-industrial complex. We can't rely on any administration or government officials. We've got to put the pressure on them.
Yeah, I read what you had to say about Mike Huckabee. I didn't realize he was so extreme.
Yeah, Huckabee, and I think this is dangerous because he doesn't really have a rational worldview. He's a, you know, Christian fundamentalist, and he views it in the lens of the Bible, and that, you know, he doesn't even think the West Bank exists. He thinks it's Samaria and Judea, the ancient provinces of the Jewish people that belongs to the Jewish people, and so he supports annexation. And he's in alliance here with the extreme right-wing elements in Israel who support the forging of a greater Israel and have no regard for Palestinian rights or desire for a state, which they don't view as legitimate in any way. So there's no hope in really advancing a peace process. And he's had, you know, hawkish views. particularly with regard to the Middle East. And yeah, it kind of aligns with this Pete Hegseth, the defense secretary, had these Christian tattoos that basically celebrate the Christian crusades against Muslims. So we're seeing some really zealous anti-Muslim figures and Christian fundamentalists being appointed in the Trump administration and having influence on Trump's Middle East policy, and that is very disturbing.
You know, Jeremy, we only have 3 or 4 minutes left, and I know you have a call as well in 5 minutes. So I just want to mention to the audience that they need to go to the website, covertactionmagazine.com, and maybe you can mention one of the pieces that you had written a few earlier this week or late last week that really impressed me, because I've always been a big fan of Dennis Kucinich. And so tell us a little bit about Dennis and why you wrote that article. Of course, the title of the article, I'm going to pull it up. Progressive stalwart Dennis Kucinich sees in 2024 vote a rejection of globalist agenda and Democratic Party warmongering. That's the title of your piece.
Sure, yeah, and Kucinich ran for Congress. You know, I don't know how old, he's well into his 70s, I guess, now, but he ran for U.S. Congress in Ohio as an independent because he left the Democratic Party. You know, he served in the U.S. Congress representing the state of Ohio for 15 or perhaps close to 20 years, and, you know, he didn't make it this time, although he did fairly well for an independent. But, you know, he's kept a consistent principle throughout his career. He's fought against big corporations. He's always been on the peace side. Even Democrats, you know, you have a lot of people in the Democratic Party who oppose Republican wars like Iraq, but then they ally with wars that are waged by Democratic Party leaders like Ukraine. You know, it's been disappointing that Bernie Sanders and a lot of the squad, for instance, in support of Ukraine and NATO, but not Kucinich. He was a speaker at the Rage Against the War Machine rally, and he had fought Obama on Libya. In fact, he tried to oppose, to impeach Obama for carrying out the bombing of Libya illegally, I think without congressional consent. And he was spied upon by the Obama administration. They tapped his phones, illegally spied upon. And he's, you know, come out against CIA excesses in the past. He support a measure to transform the Federal Reserve, you know, and to have the control over the money supply more in the public domain and control through Congress. And then, you know, his career goes back. The article discusses his book. You know, he published a political memoir about 5 years ago, which I highly recommend, that discusses his tenure as mayor of Cleveland when he fought to preserve public control over the utility in Cleveland to keep prices down. And he faced his campaign by a private company who wanted to develop a monopoly over the utilities and attacked him. They organized strikes against him, media smears. You know, they organized a garbage strike, you know, to get people upset with him that he couldn't, you know, control things. And they basically tried to ruin the economy in Cleveland to bring him down, to get in a leader who would privatize the utilities. And it's similar kind of to what the U.S. government or CIA will do against leftists or socialist leader like in South America, like Marco Rubio champions those kind of policy where they'll create strikes. And, you know, Kissinger famously said, make the economy scream in Chile when they elected a socialist. And basically the powerful elements in the city of Cleveland were doing that to try and undermine Kucinich. They were trying to destroy the economy and provoke strikes that would delegitimize his administration.
Well, I'm going to have to. We only have a minute left, and I know you have a call, but I can only encourage people to go to your website, Covert Action Magazine, and read that piece on Dennis Kucinich. And I really appreciate you being with us today, Jeremy.
And I can only, as I say, encourage the listeners to go and check out all the articles on your site, not only the ones that you've written, but there's so many others there that are so relevant to what's happening today. So thank you so much, Jeremy.
Thank you.
And we'll talk to you again. Okay, bye.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Support for WSLR in Fogartyville comes from